Well, it's a great privilege for me to be here addressing such a crowd of you, and I'm particularly grateful to Mrs. Minette Drumright Pratt and her family for endowing the lecture and making it possible for me to come over from England, and to Dr. Bellinger and my colleagues in the Religion Department and Truett Seminary for arranging this visit. I've hugely enjoyed wandering the Baylor campus and enjoying your wonderful November weather. It was kind of mist and fog and snow back home, so I might just come back here, you know, and sit out the winter here. I heard from Dr. Still on my way in here that Waco used to be a place that was famous for the production of cotton. And a couple of miles from where I live in Cheshire, sort of South Manchester, there is an old cotton mill called Stile Mill that was founded in 1789. It's now a museum. But that was one of the first places to import American cotton into the United Kingdom and kickstart the cotton trade, which is responsible for the prosperity of the region where I live. So maybe that's a connection as well with Waco. Now, what is history? Well, there's a very English work called 1066 and all that. I don't know if any of you have come across it, which defines history as what you can remember. This book was published in 1926, 1930, and was based on extensive research among students and deduced that history, there's only one date that matters in history because there's only one date that people could remember. And that was the date 1066, which is important in English history because it's the date of the Norman conquest. They did try 1492, but I'm afraid that didn't make it as a significant date. But I think that's a good reminder that as the raw material of history increases in bulk, we get more conscious than ever that the virtual data banks of information that we have about the past are just that. They're just data banks. They're not history, but raw data. They're inert and inoperative until we can retrieve and reactivate them as part of a living memory system. In an era when information has become a form of technology, it's salutary to be reminded that the prime carriers of information between one human generation and another, even in the modern university, are still people. Even in a technological age, social memory, the events and mechanisms that serve to pass on social capital from one generation to another, is vital for the well-being of human community. So we could say, in essence, the question, how do we know about Jesus, is the same question that we have to ask about all our knowledge of the past. How do we know about what happened in history? How do we get from the event, what really happened sometime way back in the past, to the written record that we can access? In the 21st century, we become used to more or less instant transfer from event to text, letters, diaries, news reports, speeded up nowadays and through the electronic messages that can buzz text and pictures instantly around the world. And here I have to display the baby. This is Baby Bear, okay? I just got the pictures today. But even in the ancient world, okay, we have letters, we have diaries, we have reports written by people who are involved in the events they write about, like St. Paul, for example. But we know it isn't like that with the great events that lie at the heart of our Christian faith. Jesus was a teacher, a healer, a wonder worker. He was more than that, but that's enough to start with. His life, death, and resurrection made a profound impression on those who knew him. But he didn't write anything down himself. All that we know about Jesus comes from texts, from narrative reports, which are included in this, the Greek New Testament, which were written down anything up to 60 years after his death. So my question really today is, how do we bridge the gap? It's not a huge gap, but it's a significant gap between the Jesus event and the texts, the Gospels, in which his story is written down. What happened in between? How was the story of Jesus preserved and passed down in memory and tradition. Now, there are three models that have dominated the study of the gospel tradition throughout the 20th century, and some of you, I'm sure, will be aware of this. Gospel as text, gospel as tradition, gospel as oral history. If people focus on the gospels as text, you're working the way the traditional synoptic criticism worked, with its successes in redaction criticism and narrative criticism. You're focusing on the written deposit of the Jesus tradition. You might be interested in looking at sources and quotations, or you might simply be concentrating on characters, for example, the final shape of the written gospels, because in one sense, that's all we can get our hands on. But gospel critics have been interested for a long time in getting behind those written texts to the traditions on which they're based, thinking about the period of oral tradition, recognizing that the memorizing the story of Jesus or the memorializing of that story is itself a structured process. So people have looked to find different models of oral transmission between the event and the written text, raising questions about the process of tradition itself. What is it for? How is it used? How is it controlled and formalized? So over the years, gospel scholars have drawn on a number of different models to understand those processes. The classic form critics at the beginning of the 20th century drew heavily on a kind of folk tradition model, and they were criticized for offering a model of oral tradition that seemed very uncontrolled and uncertain, operating over generations. In reaction to this, in 1961, the Norwegian scholar Birger Gerhardsen wrote a book called Memory and Manuscript, in which he argued that we should think more about the disciples as students in a school, like the rabbinic schools, where he argued there was a very formal, controlled method of passing down tradition. More recently, people have begun to think again about the Gospels as oral history. Samuel Bierskog, in 2000, proposed that we should look at the way people who work in the field of oral history collect historical information from the memories of eyewitnesses and participants, for example, from Holocaust survivors, focusing on memory as a mental act and on how we can validate the claim to eyewitness testimony. A recent study by Richard Borkum, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, takes this further. That came out in 2006. He locates memory, the memory of Jesus, primarily in the powers of individuals to remember what had happened to them, people like Bartimaeus, the people who were actually there. They passed down their memories to the Christian tradition, he argues. He's almost cutting out the stage of tradition and saying we can go straight from personal memory to written text. I didn't know this when I planned this lecture, but the current issue of JSNT, Journal for the Study of the New Testament, which I'm sure you have in your library, carries two review essays on Richard Borkum's book and a response by Richard Borkum, and it'll also be a subject of a panel at the SBL meeting in Boston, to which some of us are going over the weekend, so that would be worth looking at. It was interesting reading those reviews, one by a German scholar, Jens Schröter, essentially restates a classic form critical model. He says, no, you've got to have a period of tradition. You can't go straight from eyewitness to text. Borkum simply rejects that. Now, I find Richard Borkum's a friend of mine, and there's an immense amount of valuable reflection in his book. But I find reading this stuff, the debate always threatens to descend into an unresolved standoff between two irreconcilable positions on the nature of the Jesus tradition. What we need, it seems to me, to help move the debate forward is a new model of how memory and tradition work in actual human communities, a concrete social model. And that's what I'm trying to explore in this paper. Now, studies of gospel tradition in recent years have been dominated by the search for a middle way between that apparently uncontrolled folk tradition model and the very formal controlled model that Gerhardsen set up of the rabbinic academies. And an important person in this debate is Ken Bailey, who's been a Christian missionary who spent a lifetime of living and working among Christians in the Middle East. He pointed out that in the Middle East, he said, American missionaries very often come and try to play a game with a youth group. The Chinese whispers game, you know that game where you stand people around in a ring and you start off a story, you whisper it into the first person's ear and they whisper it to the next. And then at the end, you see how the story has mutated and changed into something different. He said, the problem is Middle East students find it completely pointless because the story is basically the same at the end of the chain as it was at the beginning. They work in an oral culture where memory and tradition work in a different way from what we're used to. And that, I think, is part of the problem. We work in such a text-based culture, such a literate culture, that we've forgotten how the processes of oral transmission work. So he finds in the Middle Eastern villages that he's studied, there are three kinds of oral tradition. There is the totally uncontrolled, informal tradition, that's where you're telling jokes or passing on news or hearsay, which is more or less totally unreliable, just like gossip in any society. There might be some truth in it, but it's very hard to find. There is also a very controlled, formal kind of memory and tradition, where scholars evince prodigious feats of memorizing whole texts. So a Muslim scholar would memorize the whole of the Quran, or a Christian. He cites a Christian taxi driver who had memorized the whole of the Book of Psalms and could just recite it off while he was driving by heart. So to us, that seems an extraordinary feat. But that's really memory based on a fixed text. But he finds in between those two, there is a third way, what he called controlled but informal storytelling in communities, in village, a church group, a family. He found different kinds of tradition are passed down that way, proverbs, story riddles, poetry, and stories. And he says, stories are a primary form of discourse in the Middle East. Meaning is created, problems are solved, history is remembered, theology is formulated, the grieving are comforted, youth are instructed, wisdom is proclaimed, and identity is confirmed, all by means of telling stories. And he describes village gatherings known as Haflat Samar, where the community retells the stories that form its identity. Now, as he says, in one way, this is like folklore in that these are anecdotes, people telling stories that have no chronological place in history. But nevertheless, they're not uncontrolled. They're controlled by the fact that they're told publicly within the community. And whereas the formal controlled kind of memorizing has no flexibility, and the gossipy, newsy kind of storytelling has total flexibility, this intermediate mode of passing on stories has some flexibility, but not total. So the storyteller needs to follow the main lines of the story, but they can vary the dramatic details. They can expand the story or summarize it at will. He tells how something that happens in a village scene, is condensed after 3 days into a few sentences and then is repeated verbatim all around the community. So after a few days of being quite fluid, it becomes a fixed tradition, which is then stable over years and generations. And it's particularly, he says, the key stories that function as carriers of the community's identity, which are told and retold in these informal settings. A wide degree of flexibility and narrative detail, but they're nevertheless controlled because they're publicly recited and able to be corrected within the community. And typically, such stories can't be told by just anybody. They are entrusted to key people in the community who have the job of bearing the tradition. They are often community leaders, and they in turn pass them on to others who become reliable bearers of tradition. So even without writing, these stories can be passed down quite reliably over generations. Now, Ken Bailey's picture of how tradition works in the Middle East has been seized on by a number of scholars as a helpful approach to understanding how the gospel of tradition might have worked. For example, Jimmy Dunn, who I think gave this lecture not too many years ago in his book Jesus Remembered. Now, we might agree that Ken Bailey's Middle Eastern villagers are a lot closer to Jesus and his disciples than us European or North American scholars and students. They're closer to that world, but they're still part of the modern world. Bailey's observations are borne out by broader studies from anthropologists on how tradition works, how memory is first packaged and then performed in non-literate societies. I'd note particularly the classic work of anthropologist Jan van Siena on oral tradition as history, which I brought with me. He observes that the raw news of an event as it happened can be quite quickly packaged up as a reminiscence, and that is memory formulated for oral retelling and can then remain relatively stable as it is retold by successive generations. But as a gospel scholar, I still want to find a model from the ancient world to give us a better idea as to how memory and tradition functioned in the world of Jesus and his disciples. So I want to move back now from those modern attempts to understand memory and tradition to the ancient world. Let's begin with our oldest references to the origins of the Gospels, which occur in the writings of Justin Martyr in the 2nd century, about 150 AD, and Papias, about 130 AD. Now, I'm sure some of you will know that Justin, writing about 150, describes how Christians gather together every Sunday, on the Lord's Day, he says, and listen to readings from the prophets, so that's from the Old Testament scriptures, and from what he calls the memoirs of the apostles, the apomnemonumata, wonderful word of the apostles, which are also called gospels. And it's interesting, clearly, that he's referring to written texts which the church has that they read from. So these are texts that are read aloud to the Christian congregation on Sundays. Their inside name is Gospels, that's what Christians call them. But when he's looking for a term that outsiders will understand, he calls them the memoirs of the apostles, the apomnemonumata of the apostles. Papias, writing a couple of decades earlier, uses a similar word when he's talking about Peter, the Apostle Peter, teaching in Rome. Papias knows that when he writes around 130, the generation of the apostles, and even of those who knew them personally, is dying out. He belongs to a third generation which didn't know them in person. But he's a bit of an antiquarian, if you like, he's a bit of an anthropologist, and he takes steps to bridge that gap. So he seeks out and questions visitors and collects and passes on their traditions about Jesus. He says, if I met with anyone who had been a follower of the elders, I made it a point to inquire what was said by Andrew, Peter, or Philip, Thomas, James, John, Matthew, or any other of the disciples of our Lord. For I did not think that I would derive so much benefit from books as from the living and abiding voice. You feel if Papias had had a microphone, he would have gone around with a microphone and a tape recorder. And he describes how Mark's gospel came to be written in a very famous passage, which I'll read to you in translation. Peter, he says, was preaching the gospel in Rome, and Mark was with him as his interpreter. And he says, Mark wrote down precisely hossa apemnemonusen. Now, you just need to pick up, that's a very similar word to the apomnemonumata. He wrote down something that came out of Peter's preaching, but, Papias says, not in order. He wrote down everything that Peter said that was spoken or done by the Lord, by Jesus. For Mark had not heard or followed Jesus himself, but afterwards he was a follower of Peter, who used to fashion his teaching according to the needs of his hearers, presumably, not as if putting together a proper collection of the sayings of Jesus. So that Mark didn't do anything wrong in writing it up, hos apemnemonusen, again that word. The one thing he was careful about was not to leave out or falsify anything of what he heard. So we've got this picture of Peter preaching in Rome. Peter, of course, is somebody who knew Jesus at first hand. Mark didn't know Jesus at first hand, but he wrote down what he heard of Peter's preaching. Now, it's interesting, the key word in that is this word mnemonuo, which is this linked with the word that Justin uses to describe the Gospels. And most people translate it as remembered, because it's linked with memory. Mark wrote down what he remembered of Peter's oral preaching. It's as if you were to go away and try to write down, without taking any notes in this room, what you remember of what I say this afternoon. But the fact is, this verb mnemonuo and apomnemonuo, like most memory words in Greek and in a lot of languages, actually is about more than memory. It's about memory, remembering as a mental act. It's also about speaking. It's about mentioning something as a verbal act, and right through to making a memorial as a physical or textual record. So making a memorial in the terms, say, of a gravestone or of a written text. And I think this passage is actually not so much about what Mark remembered as about what Peter recounted. I think we should translate that Mark wrote down not what he remembered, but exactly as Peter recounted. And so as Peter's memories were packaged up into memoirs. In other words, what he's talking about is the process of memorializing, the formal codification of memory. Now, if we bear that in mind, I think we can begin to see that when Justin describes the Gospels as apomnemonumata, he's opening up three distinct but overlapping ways of thinking about the Gospels. If we translate that phrase as the memories of the apostles, we place emphasis on the fact that the Gospels contain what the apostles remembered. And that puts the focus on where the tradition comes from, and it goes back to the apostles. We could also translate it as the anecdotes, the reminiscences of the apostles, and that shifts the focus to the performance of the tradition. In other words, to memory codified, fossilized, structured, performed as anecdote or memoir. Here, oral transition becomes a process in its own right that can be studied, even though it's no longer accessible to us. But thirdly, for Justin, these memoirs of the apostles are already a written text. So we've gone right from memory through to reminiscence, to oral memorializing, the packaging of memory, through to the written text. Though we should note, it's still, even for Justin, a text that is accessed primarily through the ear, through being read aloud in church, in public performance, rather than through the eye, by being studied by a solitary study. Now, why does Justin use this odd phrase, the apomnemonumata of the apostles? Clearly, as I said, for him, gospel is a term that Christians use. It's insider language. But if he wants to find a term that outsiders will understand, he reaches for a different term, but it must be something that means something in Hellenistic society, in the world of the educated world of second century Rome, which is where he's writing. And it is, in fact, a word that belongs specifically to the schools of the Hellenistic world. And this is where I'm proposing we should look to find our social model, an ancient social model, for studying the operations of memory and tradition in the ancient world, in the world of Jesus and his disciples. One of the key insights of Gerhardsen's book, Memory and Manuscript, was to take seriously the fact that Jesus was a teacher and his disciples were students. That's what the word disciple or the word mathetes in Greek means. Jesus was a teacher, his disciples were students. And if you have a teacher and students, you have a school. You don't have to have a building, they can meet sitting under a tree. But you have a teacher and students, you have a school. Gerhardsen rightly suggested we should be looking at how schools operated in the Jewish world. I simply want to broaden the lens, not to deny that, because I think that's important, but to make it a little bit broader by looking at the wider context of schools and how they operated right across the ancient Mediterranean world. This, I think, gives us a durable social context for the passing on and processing of tradition. In other words, we're not talking now about random memories or village gossip, but about the operations of memory and the construction of tradition within a very specific social matrix. The apomnem and pneumata of the Hellenistic schools embody within themselves the whole complex of verbal processes that we associate with a generation of tradition, from personal memory to oral storytelling to written memoir. Now, the first part of that process necessarily is inaccessible to us because the eyes that saw and the minds that remembered have long disappeared into the dust. We can't go back and interview them. But what we have in the memoirs, in the stories that they have left us, is a window into the more visible parts of that process. And in the remainder of this paper, I want just to try and draw together what seem to me the most significant ways in which this comparing this process in the Hellenistic schools, the schools of the Greco-Roman world, might help us to advance our understanding of memory and tradition in the Jesus tradition. So I shall look first at the transition from memory to tradition. In other words, what were these anecdotes and how did they function in the schools? Secondly, the transition from tradition to text, what happens when you write down the anecdotal tradition. And finally, what this suggests about the origins of the tradition. So first of all, memory in the schools and the role of anecdotes in the life of the schools. Everybody in ancient education regarded memory as fundamental to a good education. One of the five natural faculties that mark a child's potential for education. Memory was the foundation of all knowledge in a world that could not rely on books, tables of contents, indices, library catalogues, and electronic search tools. Exercises of mental gymnastics were practiced at every level of education, aimed at strengthening the student's natural capacity for retention to levels unheard of in the modern world. Higher education was particularly concerned with developing a student's artificial memory, improving his capacity to memorize content and strengthen his ability to build rapid and effective systems for learning. I hope you guys are taking note of all this, okay? This is what education is about. It's all about learning. Now, in that culture, to have a store of short, easily memorized anecdotes about key people in your past, particularly in the past of the school, was absolutely crucial. And these anecdotes came to play a significant role in the social memory of the schools. This anecdotal tradition was a treasure of cultural memory passed on in a variety of social locations. And the maxims and anecdotes that they tell are not just any memorable sayings, but the sayings of the cultural heroes. In the philosophical and medical schools, they encode the school's social memory of the values and lifestyle of the founder. They're particularly important in constructing the social memory of those philosophers who didn't write anything down, like Jesus. That's principally Socrates and Diogenes the Cynic, these charismatic founding figures whose philosophy was encapsulated not in writings but in their memory of their life and actions. But what was passed on in these anecdotes was not a verbally exact repetition, but the gist of a story. It was a story that could be told in different ways. And in fact, the Greek educational system encouraged students to tell stories in different ways. So there's flexibility built into that model. These reminiscences exemplify the process described by anthropologist Jan van Ziena, where news is shaped into reminiscences. These are the basic building blocks of oral tradition, which can become, as we've seen, relatively stable within a short time and then can survive transmission across many generations. At the heart of the process is the formalized process of apomnemonusis, recounting or commemorating, in which personal memories are shaped and processed into reminiscences. Let me give you an example from the life of Aristotle by Diogenes Laertius, who describes once an occasion when Diogenes the Cynic offered Aristotle a fig. Aristotle could see that Diogenes had a joke ready to respond if Aristotle refused to take the fig. since Diogenes was a notably cynics were the philosophers who believed you should be natural in everything and like not wash was a good thing. So taking a fig from this figure, sort of filthy figure who was begging on the street, might not be something that would appeal to a fastidious person like Aristotle. But he didn't want to be the butt of Diogenes' wit, so he took the fig and remarked that Diogenes had lost both his fig and his joke, his riposte. The Greek word there is kreia. Now, what's interesting about that story is, A, that's a story, an example of an anecdote about a philosopher, but B, you can see there that the kreia, this joke, is something that you practice. It's not something that just happens. It's something that Diogenes was sort of turning over in his mind. In other words, it's a piece of performance art in an oral setting. It's the end product of a careful and conscious process of mental composition. Now, the later sources, like Diogenes Laertius, give us a huge number of anecdotes about the philosophers of that type. Some of them appear to us simply trivial, some of them are funny, but they encapsulate something important about the essence of the person's life. So these anecdotes is a compressed form of narrative, usually in a single sentence in Greek, which conveys a piece of wisdom in the form of a saying, Aristotle used to say this, a response, somebody asked this and he replied, a response to a situation, seeing so-and-so, he responded, or a didactic action. One of my favorites is, again, a Diogenes the Cynic one. Diogenes, on seeing an ill-educated child, beat his paedagogos, beat his tutor. Just think about that one. He didn't beat the child, he beat the tutor. That's one for the faculty to be worrying about. Now, ancient educators had a variety of technical terms for these little stories. They tried to distinguish between the gnome, which is a pure maxim or saying, wise saying, or the kreia, this sort of very short compressed saying, or the apomnemonuma, which is a slightly longer one. In fact, I don't think those distinctions matter terribly much because in practice the names seem to be interchangeable. Some of them depend for their point on an encounter with a historical figure, like the famous one, again, Diogenes the Cynic, sitting in his barrel on the street, clad in nothing but a filthy loincloth. It meets Alexander the Great, the conqueror of the world. And Alexander the Great says to him grandly, is there anything I can do for you, my man? And Diogenes says, can you just stand out of my light? Others evoke a series of encounters with stock figures. There are stories about a teacher encountering the father of one of his students. That's quite an interesting stock occasion. Or seeing a woman, usually rude stories about women, rude stories about people of other races. So there's a lot of stuff in this. Some of this stuff is very wise, some of it's quite jokey, quite rude. But there's always a recognizable narrative pattern where you get the speaker, the situation, and the saying, which is the point of the story. Now, how are we going to compare that with what we get in the Gospels? A number of people have done detailed comparisons with these anecdotal traditions and shown there are both similarities and differences at surface level. But the anecdote is a sufficiently stable form to allow for cross-cultural comparison. And though while relatively few gospel anecdotes are as compressed as the Greek kreia, the underlying narrative structure can be accommodated without difficulty to this tradition because the focus is always on the teacher, is always the main character, and the teacher meets somebody and then there is a response, a riposte, a saying. It's interesting, if you go through the narrative stories in the Gospels, the majority of them culminate in a saying of some kind, whether it's a saying of Jesus, a response of the disciples, who then is this that the wind and the sea obey him, or a saying from Scripture. Some New Testament scholars have attempted in making this comparison to draw a hard and fast distinction between wisdom tradition, sayings tradition, and actions of Jesus. In fact, when you look at the Hellenistic school's saying tradition, it shows that it's dangerous to make some of the assumptions there. They've tended to argue that the wisdom tradition, the sayings tradition, is automatically earlier than the biographical stories. But actually, in the Hellenistic school's tradition, we see they're side by side. And interestingly, it's equally dangerous to be dogmatic about length. People often assume in gospel criticism that the shortest form of a story is the earliest. So in the Gospel of Thomas, for example, maybe that's the earliest form of the gospel stories, which got expanded by later retellings. But in fact, if you look at the Hellenistic school tradition, the longer form seems to be the earliest. All the pressure is to make the story shorter and more compressed, which would reverse the dating patterns there. Now, what was the function of these biographical anecdotes? They were there, in a way, to preserve biographical information about the teacher, the founder of the school. But that's only one of their functions. They can serve the needs of polemic, ethical instruction, and simple frivolous curiosity. Underneath that, though, I think we can see there's a common underlying function of identity formation. Thus, there's a whole lot of stories about conversion to philosophy, which have a clear protreptic function. It's part of encouraging other people to follow the same route. You can parallel those in the Gospels and Acts. Conflict stories serve the needs of boundary definition. Even the more frivolous anecdotes play their part. There's nothing more powerful in cultural bonding than a shared joke. But underneath all this is a clear understanding that the core function of anecdotes is to be psychological capsules, if you like, clues to a person's soul. The sayings and deeds of the sages are the fundamental building blocks in the construction of a paranetic discourse centered on imitation. They provide the paradigms, the exemplary types, which at every stage of ancient education were presented to the student. Let me read you something from one of the letters of Seneca, writing to a young friend who wants to learn how to live an ethical life. He says, "The miser, the swindler, the bully, the cheat, who would do you a lot of harm by simply being near you, they are actually inside you. You need to move to better company. Live with Roman heroes like Cato, Lilius, Tubero. If you like Greek company, attach yourself to Socrates and Zeno. One will teach you how to die when it's forced upon you, the other how to die before it's forced upon you. Live with Chrysippus, Poseidonius, these are Stoic teachers. They will give you a knowledge of man and the universe. They will tell you to be a practical philosopher, not just to entertain your listeners to a clever display of language, but to steel your spirit and brace it against whatever threatens." Now, what he's saying there is not just about reading the writings of these philosophers, but about getting to know their character, and that you do by getting to know these anecdotes. And it's this belief that the lifestyle of a teacher, the teacher's bios, is just as important as the writings or verbal teachings that gives these anecdotes their underlying seriousness. Even the most trivial details may have something to teach the willing student. These anecdotes embody the essence of the man himself. Perhaps I might pause to tell you a rabbinic story which makes the same point, though in typical rabbinic fashion. There was a famous rabbinic sage called Rabbi Akiva, and he had a very keen student. And Rabbi Akiva said that the student should follow his teacher wherever he is and learn by imitating the lifestyle of his teacher. So one day Rabbi Akiva was in the toilet and he found this student hiding behind the door. So he said, "What are you doing? It is rude. Get out." And the student said, "Master, it is Torah and I need to know." So on another occasion, Rabbi Akiva and his wife were in bed at night and he heard a noise under the bed and there is this student. They said, "Get out, for it is rude." And the student said, "Master, it is Torah and I need to know." That's, as I say, it's a typical rabbinic joke about what it meant to be a student, but there's an underlying serious point there, and the Greeks would have agreed with that. So these anecdotes embody the essence of the man himself. They are, as Plutarch says, samples and primal elements. They are seeds of the philosophic life. So by implication, when those seeds are implanted in the student, they can engender the philosophical life in the student. Just to close that section, Xenophon says of the character of Socrates, his teacher, this was his character. How could he have led others into crime, gluttony, or lust, or sloth? On the contrary, he cured these vices in many by putting into them a desire for goodness and by giving them confidence that self-discipline would make them gentlemen. To be sure, he never professed to teach this, but by letting his own light shine, he led his disciples to hope that they, through imitation of him, would attain to such excellence. So what we see, I would suggest, in the Gospels and Acts is a Christian alternative to this, a Christian data bank of cultural heroes, of course, with Jesus himself at the fore as the primary model for Christians to emulate, acting as countercultural exemplars to all these pagan examples that people would get in their Greek or Roman education. These reminiscences of the apostles supply the seeds that hold not just information about the past, but the key to a whole way of life. Now, what was the means by which this teaching was passed on? It was a lot of it to do with repetition and also exercises of constant telling and retelling of these anecdotes. And one of the images that ancient educators use for this process is the image of imprinting to express the effect of perception and the persistence of memory, implying that the student is indelibly marked by what he is exposed to. He is physically distinct from those who have not undergone this education. Now, that leads us to ask, where would we look for this kind of process to go on, if this social model I'm advocating is a good one, within the Christian church? Justin had a school, but it seems clear to him that for him, the place where Christians learn, hear the anecdotes of the apostles, and just thus learn what it means to follow Christ, is in the regular Sunday meetings of the Christian assembly. These anecdotes form part of the regular instruction of all Christians. Now, these notices by second century writers are often dismissed, but my point would be that even if you're going to be very skeptical about them, as SCOM scholars would be, they wouldn't work even as propaganda if they didn't present a plausible picture to ancient auditors. And what they present, I suggest, is a picture of early Christian education at work. Peter, like most ancient teachers, gathers a disciple circle around him and teaches them in public by passing on to them his own reminiscences of the words and deeds of his teacher, Jesus. Listening to this once is not enough. Peter's hearers want to be able to commit it to memory, and they expect Mark, as a member of the inner disciple circle, to be able to produce a written version from memory. This oral performance tradition is still a live one in the mid-second century. Papias expects, as we've seen, to be able to quiz the followers of the Lord's disciple to hear this living voice of apostolic tradition. Papias himself belongs to a parallel tradition based on the Johannine traditions as taught by the elders in Asia. He claims that his writings are based on what I learned well and remembered well as a student from his own teachers. Irenaeus tells us of the disciple circle of Polycarp passing on the traditions of John. And there's a wonderful description that Irenaeus gives us of Polycarp's school. He says, "While I was still a boy, I knew you in Lower Asia in Polycarp's house when you were a man of rank. I remember the events of those days more clearly than those which happened recently. For what we learn as children grows up with the soul and is united to it, so that I can speak even of the place in which the blessed Polycarp sat and disputed, how he came in and went out, the character of his life, the appearance of his body, the discourses which he made to the people, how he used to tell us about his discipleship with John and with the others who had seen the Lord, and how he used to recount their words and what he had heard from them about the Lord and about his miracles and about his teaching. All this Polycarp used to tell us as tradition received direct from the eyewitnesses of the word of life, completely consistent with the scriptures. So you've actually got Irenaeus writing about 180 here, receiving this tradition about Jesus directly, in direct transmission from his teacher Polycarp, who got it from his teacher John, who was a disciple of the Lord. So you can see there exactly how this process of reminiscence of memory and tradition works. Irenaeus remembers not only his teacher's words, but the whole character of his life. That is the impression his life made on his pupils. I think Irenaeus also gives us a valuable glimpse into the learning strategies that undergird this oral paideia. Childhood apprenticeship. He was obviously very young when he went to this school. Eager listening, committing to memory, and a process which he calls chewing the cud. He says, I listened eagerly to these things through the mercy of God which was given me and made notes of them, not on paper but in my heart. And ever by the grace of God I do truly ruminate on them. And the word he uses is the word that for a cow chewing the cud. It does make me ask at this point, just in a footnote, what were the exercises, what were the processes that were used in these Christian schools to imprint the stories of the apostles, the memories of the apostles on those who heard them? Now, I'm nearly at an end. I'm just going to speak very briefly about the transition from memoir to text, because again, I think there's some interesting parallels there between what we see in the Hellenistic philosophical schools and what we see in the early church. The transition from oral tradition to a written text seems to be a two-stage progression. Once memory has achieved the relatively stable form of anecdote, it's quite easy to transfer that to writing. The written text here serves a mediary role in a fluid and creative performance tradition, capturing a fleeting moment between performance and reoralization. Texts are simply data banks in which reminiscences are being collected, organized, and recombined in elastic formats that open up new possibilities of access and reoralization. Sometimes the transfer to writing can happen within a generation, like Xenophon's Memories of Socrates or Lucian's of Demonax. Otherwise, other times it can take much longer. We actually have papyri from the ancient world, which are collections of anecdotes. They're not bioi, they're not a structured biography, they're simply unattached collections of anecdotes, and they seem to show this kind of intermediate form of written collection. But then in the second century we get a secondary phase of scholastic activity, textualization, seeking to identify, collect oral traditions, codify it, to combine it with other kinds of tradition like the chronology and successions. Now, I think we can see a similar two-stage progression in early Christianity. Both Papias and Justin, I think, belong to the scholastic phase, and it's interesting they come from the same date. But they are drawing on both on oral traditions and on written traditions where the anecdotes are already written down in what to Papias is a rather unsatisfactory and intermediate form. His description of Mark's gospel makes it clear he thinks Mark didn't do a very good job. Now, if that's right, that means that the gospels themselves belong to this initial stage of the transfer of writing of the raw anecdotal tradition. As we see, by the time of Justin, they already have a place in Christian liturgy. They are being read in worship services on a Sunday. But they're written only to be re-performed in a liturgical context, and they may well have functioned as a graphic data bank for Christian preachers and teachers, a collection of stories of Jesus to be quarried and recombined in live performance. You might say, however, but surely that's not what the Gospels are, because formally speaking, they're clearly more complex than the disconnected anecdote collections that we see in the papyri. In that sense, something like the Gospel of Thomas, I think, does provide a closer analogy with its more loosely connected sequence of sayings and anecdotes. In fact, as I've argued elsewhere, although there are many parallels at the level of anecdotes, it's quite difficult to find a convincing parallel in the Greek biographical tradition for the narrative complexity of the Gospels. And I think that's partly due to the overall shape of the Gospel tradition, with its unusually tight focus on the words and deeds of one teacher. There's only one teacher who matters in the Christian tradition. That's not a natural or inevitable progression, but is a creative outworking of a fact about the Jesus movement, that Jesus was far more important in Christian tradition than any single philosophy was in the Hellenistic school tradition. It's also, I think, worth saying that there's no reason to assume that once texts are written down, the oral storytelling stops. In fact, all the evidence is that it doesn't. Incidentally, we can see that even in the New Testament. You remember Paul, in his address to the Ephesian elders at Miletus, quotes a saying of Jesus. He says, "You remember how the Lord said, 'It is more blessed to give than to receive.'" Where will you find that in the Gospels? Nowhere. He's quoting something which he has heard from oral tradition, which never got into our written Gospels. And there are sayings still being quoted from oral tradition in the second century, which may well be genuine part of the Jesus tradition, but they just didn't get into the Gospels. Now, some scholars have argued that because the Jesus tradition still seems to be quite fluid in the second century, therefore the Gospels didn't have authoritative status. They weren't canonic texts. I think that's actually a mistake. I think it's a mistake to conclude from this fluidity that the texts are not authoritative. On the contrary, within the framework of the Hellenistic school tradition, it's precisely because of their iconic status that certain texts and traditions are accorded the honor of constant reshaping and performance. In a performative culture, it's the texts that matter that are selected for continual paraphrase, elution, and creative rewriting. Let me conclude by taking this back now. We've got from memory to reminiscence to text, and obviously I could say huge amount more about all of those, but it's time to bring this to an end. But let me just take this back now. How can we get back from the text, which is all we have, to the events which sparked it all off? This preliminary survey, I think, shows, at least it's shown me, that there is abundant testimony to the importance of memory in the Hellenistic schools. It's assumed across the curriculum at every level and emphasized in particular ways at the top level, at tertiary level. What's less clear is the role of personal testimony. To what extent did the schools value preserving a personal link with their founders through the reminiscences of disciples? Where the memory belongs to the first generation, the link with personal testimony is quite straightforward. Again, Lucian, as an example, his Life of Demonax, is based on the author's own memory of his teacher, and he says his object in writing is to perpetuate that memory in future generations, so that, as he says, that he may be retained in memory by men of culture, that young men of good instincts may not have to shape themselves by ancient examples alone, but may be able to set themselves a pattern from the modern world and to copy that man, the best of all the philosophers whom I know about. You get something very similar in Xenophon's Apomnemonumata, his reminiscences of Socrates, where he says, "The very recollection of him in absence brought no small good to his constant companions and followers, for even in his light moods they gained no less from his society than when he was serious." But despite these examples, I think the anecdotal tradition is not on the whole structured in such a way as to give undue weight to the personal testimony of the tradents. What's important is the objective value of the memory kept alive across successive generations, rather than the name of the person who passed it on. And I think there may be a difference there in the Greek tradition from the rabbinic tradition. What's at issue is not so much the reliability of personal memories as the faithful following of a particular teaching tradition. The emphasis is on authentic performance in the present rather than on a static process of passing on data. But what is clear, I think, to me is that the schools formed a vehicle, a motivating matrix for the formation and preservation of biographical anecdotes about teachers and their disciples, especially where the person of the teacher came to be regarded as the embodiment of the teaching of the school. So when we turn back to Luke, for example, and look at the book of Acts and Luke's picture of the collegium of the apostles focused on the ministry of the word, so passing on the teaching and the stories of Jesus and interpreting its significance in the light of the Hebrew scriptures, that's exactly what we should expect in the light of the Hellenistic school tradition. The task of memorializing and codifying the school's inner tradition was too important to be left to the chances of memory. It was an essential bearer of identity, and to see its preservation as part of the task of the teacher's disciples is entirely plausible. For Luke and his successors, it is the disciples of Jesus who have the status of eyewitnesses, as Luke himself describes them in Luke 1, verse 2, rather than, I think, as Borkum suggests, the people who participated in the stories. I wouldn't rule that out, but I think the stories themselves point to the disciples as the eyewitnesses. It's the apostles, the members of the disciple circle, who are appointed to shape and transmit the Jesus tradition and who therefore control access to it. And that's a picture endorsed indirectly, of course, by Paul in Galatians. Now, whether or not that picture is historically accurate is, strictly speaking, outside the scope of this paper. That's not something I can prove from this model. But I think we can observe that that pattern is borne out, and this is my final point, by the grammatical structure of the anecdotal tradition itself. In an anecdote, the typical apomnemoneuma, the sage, the wise person, does not speak in his own voice. The narrative structure presupposes an observer, a recording mind, somebody who is neither the sage nor the persons he encounters along the way, be they questioners or the objects of his gaze. In other words, the disciple circle plays an invisible but essential role in the dramatic structure of the anecdote, the apomnemoneuma. This is the invisible third party to whom the sage speaks, for whose benefit he performs didactic actions, and implicitly by whom his wisdom is recorded and committed to memory. Teresa Morgan, who has studied ancient education, notes this on a series of anecdotes of Diogenes the Cynic. She says, "The first thing to note is the relative position of the protagonists. Diogenes is probably to imagine talking to a group of admirers or students, and the reader or listener is as if part of the group, laughing appreciatively at the master's wit. The objects of his observations are all at a distance and on a par, both spatially and grammatically, separated from the group by the word seeing, which begins each sentence, and which serves to distance the object from the seeing subject." The grammatical structure, in other words, of the anecdote, serves both to distance the reader from the scene being described and to draw him or her into the complicity of the disciple circle. Diogenes, as grammatical subject, dominates and controls the hearer's viewpoint. But as the subject of a third-person narrative, is himself the object of the hearer's mimetic gaze. Okay? The controlling perspective of the disciple circle serves simultaneously to authenticate the narrative as observation and, by drawing in its auditors, to create new disciples. That, I would say, argue, is what the underlying structure of these anecdotes does. And I think it would be hard to think of a better definition of the form and function of the gospel tradition. That is, simultaneously to authenticate the narrative as eyewitness tradition about the master himself, and by drawing in those who listen to these stories to create new disciples, new members of the disciple circle. Thank you.